The Process, a podcast about creativity and experimental music. In the world of experimental music, outcomes and accolades for creators can be uncertain and at times seem far and few between. Therefore, creators and practitioners of experimental music must embrace the one thing they will always have complete control over, the process. This podcast aims to understand this creative process by listening to new works and discussing them with their creators. Each episode focuses on one creator and their music. Understanding how and why they create can inform aspiring creatives and help audiences better understand and navigate experimental music. I'm Dr. Doug Bielmeyer, and I'll be your host as we explore the world of experimental music, creativity, and the human need to find purpose in their world and lives. This is The Process. Marty Epstein is a composer whose music has been performed by the San Francisco Symphony, the Radio Symphony Orchestra of Frankfurt, Ensemble Modern, and members of the Boston Symphony. She has completed commissions from the Fromm Foundation, the Iowa Brass Quintet, Long East School of Music, the Gorilla Opera, the Radius Ensemble, Tanglewood Music Center, and Boston Opera Collaborative. She has been a recipient of a Massachusetts Cultural Council grant. Marty has twice been a fellow at the Tanglewood Music Center and has been in residence at the McDowell Colony. During the 2017-2018 concert season, Marty's work was featured extensively alongside the work of Anton Webern on the Trinity Wall Street Times Aero Festival in New York City. Her music was also performed by the Boston Symphony Orchestra Chamber Players in Leipzig, Germany in June 2018. Her opera Rumpelstiltskin was presented with shadow puppetry in May 2019 in New York City. Marty is professor of composition at Berklee College of Music, Boston Conservatory of Music.
The most important thing is that I usually don't sit down to write a new piece. It's been maybe 15 years since I haven't had a specific person or project that I'm writing for. So that's the first thing, is that I know who I'm writing for. If I don't already have an idea for the piece, I usually will, you know, listen to what that person or that group has done. I'm writing a piece right now for the Hinge Ensemble, which is saxophone, electric guitar, piano, and percussion. And so I've been watching all of their videos. So that's where I start. And then I almost always have some kind of visual image, a word that gives me some sort of image, or an actual painting or a picture. And that usually suggests some kind of sonic image, an imagined sound world. And then my job as a composer is to try to figure out, what is this sound that I'm hearing? How can I make it travel through time and become an actualized piece of music? And then how do I write it down so that other people can play it? And usually when I sit down at my desk, a lot of that is already worked out in my head. And then I'm just really trying to find the exact right pitches or rhythms or textures to get that to happen.
So when you're saying you're not sitting down, are you going for a walk? Are you doing something else and thinking and ruminating about this all and thinking about it?
Yeah, I'm walking, I'm swimming sometimes. Sometimes I'm bored at a concert. There's something about, you know, hearing music and not being engaged with it that activates that part of my brain. And sometimes, like, I'm copying a piece right now. I'm doing the engraving, which I do by hand. And sometimes when I'm doing that kind of work, which is musical, but it's not creative necessarily, I start to think about what I'm doing for the next piece. Sometimes I'm thinking about it when I'm lying awake.
You mentioned that you were talking about the Hinge Ensemble, mm-hmm. and you were talking about watching videos of the ensemble as sort of the preparation to write them a piece. Mm-hmm. So why are you watching videos of them?
Well, I did go to their concerts, but now they're not having concerts.
Right.
So
right.
I'm watching their videos so that I can absorb how these four instruments can work together and the various pieces they play. I know all four people very well, but as individuals, not as a collective. So, and then I've never written for electric guitar before. I've written a lot for classical guitar, but I've never written for electric guitar. So I actually asked Dan Van Hassel, he's the guitarist, I actually asked him to make me videos of himself playing with all of his pedals and everything so that I can try to understand what they're doing.
So you do some research, you listen to the groups, you sort of ruminate over these ideas, and then you sit down. So you mentioned you sit down at your desk and you're writing things by hand.
Yeah.
Is there a piano or an instrument involved as you're doing this, or is this just notes to the page? What's the process after you're ready to commit?
That's a really good question. So my desk is right across from my piano, but I don't sit at the piano and compose. A lot of the work I do is trying to hear the sounds in my head. I don't have perfect pitch, so I need to orient myself. But I audioize, not visualize, but audioize, and I may have made that word up.
It's a great one. I'm going to steal it.
Please. I do that much better away from any sort of sound-producing object than I do sitting at the piano. And I think part of it is that I've been playing the piano almost my entire life. And so I tend to play things that I can play.
Sure.
And if I'm not writing for piano, like the Koma Rebbe, it wouldn't have made any sense for me to try to work that out on the piano. So I use the piano for orientation. I sometimes check harmonies or harmonic relationships at the piano. But I try for myself, and I try to get my students to do this too, to hear the music as precisely as possible in my head. So there's always a gap between what I'm hearing in my head and what I will actually hear musicians play. I first of all think it's not possible to completely get rid of the gap. And second of all, I don't even think it's a good thing to get rid of the gap, because I think that gap of uncertainty makes us more creative.
You mentioned the piece Como Rebbe, which is loosely translated or maybe directly translated to sunshine filtering through the trees. You mentioned using the traditional piano for this piece would not work or wasn't something that would be useful. Tell us a little bit about the process of creating this piece and getting this piece off the ground.
So this piece was a commission from Windsor Chamber Music. Windsor has amazing musicians, but it was specifically for Peggy Pearson on oboe, Ronnie Moore on clarinet, and Gabby Diaz on violin. So these are three people whose musicianship I admire. Gabby and Ronnie I have worked with many, many times. I felt like my love of their playing and their personalities created a sound world. And so I wanted the piece to be very interlocking and contrapuntal in a very community sort of way, which I think it ultimately is.
The piece in itself had sort of a Japanese vibe, sort of a gagaku ensemble. I heard some of that. Now, none of the instruments were traditional classical Japanese instruments, but there was that flavor to that, that character to it. It had that sort of exterior on it, but it was very much more about texture, register, and pacing.
One of my biggest compositional heroes is Toru Takemitsu. Now, it's very interesting because Takemitsu's music didn't start out being overtly Japanese. I could talk for hours about his whole trajectory, but he came at composing from French chanson and Debussy and all these people. And he and other composers in his generation rejected Japanese music because they felt like it was too militaristic or they didn't really like the ancient Japanese instruments. And it was John Cage who came to Tokyo and met Takemitsu. And really, John Cage was very much in love with Japanese culture and Zen Buddhism and all these things. Sure. And Cage sort of reintroduced Japanese culture and aesthetics back to Takemitsu. So I'm getting some of that aesthetics through Cage and also Morton Feldman and then back through Takemitsu. So it's this very weird, circuitous thing. But I think my music has never, even when I first started composing, it's never been overtly developmental in a Western way. It's always sure. been sort of this weird, very sparse, spacious, a lot of silence, non-developmental in a way that you might associate with more Eastern kinds of musics.
You mentioned something in some of your writings that your music is not atonal, nor is it tonal. And when I first read that, I was kind of like, come on, man. Like, is that, you know, that felt like a very John Cage thing to say. Like sometimes John Cage would say these things and they were very profound, but then very open-ended. And listening to this piece, I was like, no, she said exactly what she means. And this piece doesn't feel like there's some type of 5-7 relationships
right.
going on here.
Right.
It's more about really listening to each sort of unit and how those are relating and how it's sort of happening over time.
To me, tonality describes a very small subset of all music. You know, you mentioned 5-1. It has to have a dominant tonic relationship. The tonic doesn't have to be present necessarily, but that relationship needs to be there. And then atonal doesn't mean anything to me. I don't really know very much music that's atonal, except for maybe some Debussy whole tone music. I like the term gravitational. With this piece, with Komorebi, I had a really clear imagination of the sound world. And then I tried to imagine what pitches would give me that sound world. It's a very small pitch set. And I don't think in pitch sets, but it's a very small collection of pitches. Right. But I was interested in exploring the different registers that the three instruments have in with that limited pitch set. So, you know, an F sharp and the clarinet on the low part of the instrument is going to sound completely different than a violin playing the F-sharp at the top of its range. So I was more interested in a very economical set of pitches and a more expansive timbral and registral expression of those pitches.
You know, you mentioned these musicians were, you know, they're virtuosic musicians. There's maybe this expectation to be like, let's just write all these fast-paced, really technical, really, you know, aggressive things for them to play. And instead you create this piece of sort of about patience and about slowly evolving shapes.
Which is a kind of virtuosity. A virtuosity doesn't have to be playing a lot of notes. It can be intonation. I mean, those three women are three of the most in tune people I know. That is definitely a kind of virtuosity. The patience to rely on your inner pulse, live in a silence, or there's no such thing as silence, as Cage discovered.
Yes.
but to live in the gaps that happen between things in a piece of music, that also takes a kind of virtuosity.
So let's talk a little bit about these creative cogitations.
Okay.
Is being creative a primal urge?
If you watch a room full of children, especially very small children, like 2 or 3 years old, they are all being creative. They're all children. Little children say the weirdest, most random things, which is, I think, a sign of creativity. I think they're naturally, preternaturally creative. I think what happens is that it's not that you're creative or you aren't. It's that it's a continuum. And I think some people are maybe virtuosic in their creativity, you know, and some people aren't. But I think every human, and I've actually even seen it sometimes in animals, like high-functioning animals, the creativity, the drive to create is there. I think what happens is a lot of times it gets squashed in school or by parents. The creative core that all humans have inside of us is the good place. With some people, that good place gets completely shut down and other things happen. And maybe other things happen because of, you know, who a person is psychologically. Definitely, supposedly, nature is more important than nurture. But I do think that nurture plays a role. There are evil people who are highly creative. A lot of my compositional heroes, I have to weigh this whole thing as, you know, the art is over here and the man is over here. And it usually is a man, sadly. But because I believe that the creative urge comes from that good place, the place that transcends the evil of the human nature, I'm able to live with both of those things sort of side by side.
So you're almost saying not only is it a primal urge, but to be creative is the kinder side of human nature.
I think so.
And the creativity sort of fosters community, partnership.
I think it's primal, I think it's an urge, and I think it's separate from who we are in our personalities or who we are as humans. I mean, I define myself as a composer, I define myself as a creative person, but I have a lot of people in my life who don't know me as that. You know, I have a lot of friends who aren't musicians, and they have really no idea what it is that I do.
What do you do?
And they have a perception of me as a human that is obviously completely separate from who I am as a creator. And so that's a perfect example of it's separate from me, even though it's how I define myself.
Talking about creative cogitation 2.1, do you believe in talent or hard work?
You have to have both in equal parts. I know some composers who are very, very hardworking. Their music isn't fantastic. I would say they've gotten far through hard work. It's not imaginative in a way that would be satisfying to me. And we all know people who have so much talent and don't do anything because they don't have the drive to do it or they don't have the discipline.
Do you think it's a lifelong thing, though, too, that this idea that if you have the initial talent, that even if right away you don't learn that work ethic, you don't learn how to work it or how you work, have you noticed your work habits have changed over your career?
I think they have. I look back at you know, when I was a kid, and I would practice the piano all the time, but I would never practice what I was supposed to practice.
Right. And, well, know, that's why you're a composer, right? You were like, exactly. Hey, here's a wrong note. This sounds better. Like, let me.
That has happened. And I didn't really work that hard in school and all this stuff. So I look back and see myself as a person who didn't work that hard. When I meet people, or when I re-meet people who knew me when I was younger, they say, oh yeah, you were always like completely obsessed. So, so I think maybe, I think you can develop it later in life for sure. But I think that I've maybe always had it for music. I never really had it for, schoolwork. You know, I don't have a memory of doing homework when I was in high school, although I know I must have. But
I think I blocked most of it out.
Yeah, exactly. Algebra was not.
Yeah.
It was not the thing. So
there's another cogitation here about, and I thought this was an interesting one that you wanted to respond to. And it says, do you savor obscurity and the freedom it affords you?
So I have this weird place in modern music. I have a certain amount of success, but it's taken me a long time to get here. I mean, I'm 60 years old, so it's taken me, I applied for a Guggenheim Fellowship 28 times and then finally got it. I am
well, there's
not
the hard work.
Yeah, there you go. The masochism. I don't know. I am yes. not the first person that gets commissioned for things, you know, for shiny things. I'm the person who gets commissioned by the Ludovico Ensemble or the Henge Ensemble, you know, the more out of the way things. I think that I prefer it this way. And I always joked around saying, I want to be famous enough so that people who love the kind of music I love know my name, but I can still walk into Whole Foods completely unrecognized. and that's kind of why that question resonated with me.
So that kind of slides into, should you worry about the commercial success of your art?
I had a question for you about that. By commercial success, did you mean financial success?
I think, yeah. I think it goes into the household name idea. And when I'm saying commercial success, I'm saying, are you getting paid? So should you, as a composer, and especially, you know, you train all these future composers who are probably asking you the same questions, you know, how do I make a living out of this? What, you know, what is success? How do we gauge it?
The most important thing is artistic achievement. That's the most important thing. I compose a lot of pieces for cheap or free. I shouldn't mm-hmm. say that. Other composers get very angry at me when they hear me say that because they think I'm...
I was going to say, why do they get angry?
Because they think I'm devaluing what we do. But in fact, the opposite is true. So for me, the most important thing is the artistic goal or the artistic achievement. I'm very lucky in that I have a job. I teach at Berklee and I teach at Boston Conservatory and I've been there for 30 years and I'm a full professor and I'm getting paid, you know, in the pandemic. I am very, very lucky about that. But I think that teaching shouldn't be viewed as, oh, I'm teaching to support my composing. Teaching is I am giving the gift of helping other people figure out how to put art in the world. So for me, that's the most important thing, especially now, you know, to find a way to make art as rigorously and as satisfyingly as you can. And you can't really do that without a teacher helping you. For me, teaching is a privilege. It's not, oh God, I have to teach so that I can write this piece. It's I get to teach and I get ideas from my students and I get energized by my students. So all that is to say, I will compose for not very much money and I'm very fortunate that I can support myself by teaching. As soon as you are composing just for money, then you may, not always, but you may be sacrificing some aspect of the art. And for me, the art is the most important thing.
This has been really inspiring for me. I always love to hear like composers take on their career and then also just the world of new music. Where can we go to find out more about you and your music?
Everything I have ever written is on SoundCloud. A lot of my stuff is on YouTube, either on my channel or on the Ludovico Ensemble channel. Mm-hmm. I have a website. But to hear my music, I would say SoundCloud and YouTube are the best. I have one CD And it's by the Ludovico Ensemble. It's called Hypnagogia, and it's available on Bandcamp. I think it's on Spotify, too. I think it's wherever you would.
Wherever you stream or listen.
Yeah.
Thanks to Marty Epstein for her music, insight, and experience. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, subscribe, leave a comment or a rating on your preferred streaming application. I'm Dr. Doug Bielmeyer, and this has been The Process.